finally is coming down to a small amount of deflection. You're measuring the Q of that system. You're measuring the ring down time. Your antenna has a ring up time and a ring down time. It's got a significant Q, and it's like 20. I wonder if this all makes a little bit more sense of AC2AZ, K2LAW.
That takes a little while to swallow. I can understand the Q building up, but once you have that Q built up, I guess that's akin to an oscillator starting up. Once it's built up and the voltage is present on the antenna, does not the power that you transmit leave the antenna at that point in time? You say it travels back and forth. In that case, if I had maybe 100 meters between my antenna and my transmitter, and I sent a CW pulse out, would it not take the speed of light times 100 meters 20 times for that pulse to leave the antenna, according to, I think, what you're saying?
I see where you're going here, Bob. If the antenna was properly adjusted to be a pure 50-ohm load, the resonance I'm speaking about is within the wire of the antenna itself. And your transmission line, once it has rung up to the right amount of power, once it has gone through the rise time, the antenna presents a 50-ohm impedance, your particular antenna. So the resonance is within the antenna. The energy is bouncing back and forth between the left side of the dipole and the right side of the dipole. Your transmission line, if it's doing its job just right, makes it look like your transmitter is a miniature thing right at the feed terminals of the antenna. And what is that transmitter doing? It is gathering some electrons from the left side of the dipole and shoving them into the right side of the dipole, and it does that on the first half of the RF cycle. On the second half of the RF cycle, it's taking the electrons from the right side of the dipole and pumping them back to the left side of the dipole. Those electrons bounce back and forth. The energy that you're putting in bounces back and forth 20 times before it is radiated on average. I could look at this particular red electron coming out of the transmitter right now. I could watch it go down the transmission line. I could watch that, the energy of that electron get onto that dipole. You'd like to believe it immediately jumps into space. 5% of that energy of the little particle of energy you're now tracking, 5% of it goes into space on each cycle. And it takes approximately 20 cycles for all of it to go into space. It doesn't happen all at once. That's what resonance really means. If you don't believe that, then try to explain why when you go a little bit higher or a little bit lower in frequency, the antenna has an impedance that is so drastically different. And it's different in a very predictable manner. Let me drop. If the antenna was a little bit too long, the signal going down the end of the wire, hitting the open circuit and bouncing back, would come back a little bit late. It would be lagging in phase. You measure the impedance of the antenna, you tell me it's inductive. That's what lagging in phase is. If I make the antenna a little bit too short, the signal that goes down there comes back too fast. It's leading in phase. You and I call that capacitive. If all the energy radiated off the antenna on the first pass, there would be nothing to reflect back. When you measure the impedance as you go up and down in frequency, it wouldn't change. The fact that the impedance changes so fast as you move in frequency tells me that the majority of the energy is coming back in phase or out of phase. It's got to be resonated. That tells me there's a lot of stored energy. If it jumped into space, the impedance wouldn't change when I swept the frequency. I wonder if you see that one, Bob. AC2AZ, K2LAW.
Yeah, when you explain it that way, it sounds a little bit better. I can swallow that. But now go back to my other question about the tuner. You've got a mismatched antenna. You've got power reflected back into your tuner. And you say that does not absorb the power. So one friend of mine said that all the power, even though it's reflected, eventually bounces off your antenna tuner back to your antenna. So even though you are reflecting power, you do transmit eventually 100% of what you put into that tuner. I kind of disagree with that. I thought it gets dissipated back into the tuner, any reflected power, because you've taken that tuner and looking into it, you've matched it to the line. I believe that's what you're doing. You're matching the 50-ohm impedance between your transceiver and the tuner to some other impedance between the tuner and the antenna.
Okay, the next step here, I'm going to go step by step in two steps. Let's assume that I've got an antenna that for some crazy reason I decided to make it 1/4 of 50 ohms. It's a 12.5 ohm antenna. And I just happen to be using a 12.5 ohm transmission line. So as far as transmission line antenna is concerned, that interface is working like a charm. I come back into the shack where I've got a antenna tuner and I got a 50 ohm transmitter. That's a 4-to-1 impedance match. 12.5 ohm antenna and feed line into a 50 ohm transmitter. That would be a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio if I didn't do something. I decide to make a very simple antenna tuner. It happens to be an RF transformer with a 2-to-1 turns ratio. I get twice as many turns on the primary that's connected to the transmitter as the number of turns in the secondary that goes to the feed line. A 2-to-1 turns ratio on an RF transformer, well shielded, gives me a 4-to-1 impedance ratio. I look into that transformer, which is my simple antenna tuner, I see 50 ohms. The output after the secondary winding with 1/4 of the number of turns is 12.5 ohms. It feeds the transmission line. So that very simple antenna tuner makes a perfect impedance match in that system, even though you would say that antenna and feed line is a 4-to-1 loss, a 4-to-1 viswire compared to that transmitter. With that very simple technique, I've corrected it. I've made a very simple antenna tuner. It's a transmitter, a transformer. A more elaborate antenna tuner really is a PI network. It's got a C1 capacitor, a C2 capacitor, a tuning and loading capacitor, and a coil, and an inductor. And if I properly adjust the C1 and the C2 and the inductor, I can match almost any 4-to-1 viswire anywhere on the Smith chart you want. Okay. The next step is, let me drop this.
WHCDO.
Now, we called you before, and I'm going to be calling you again in about 4 minutes if you're still there.
I'm not going to be here.
I'm sorry. Alrighty. Say your piece. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a suggestion before when the station that called was very noisy. I wanted you to let him know, in case he's very far east and he's hearing the west repeater, he can always move over to the other input. That way he won't lose a station who wants to ask a question if he was in that location. I just wanted to mention that, you know, while I had the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, he was in New Jersey, Andy. What do you do now?
Not much. Okay. No, that's a different story, but just thought I'd mention that. All right, continue. Go ahead. I have to leave in about 2 minutes anyway. Thank you.
Okay, good suggestion. Thank you. Let me let it reset. Okay, the next step, Bob, is that I've got a 25-ohm antenna, a 50-ohm transmission line. The 25-ohm antenna and the 50-ohm transmission line is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Assume my transmission line is very low in loss. That transmission line, when I walk around that Smith chart for the right number of times representing the length of that line, presents some impedance at the antenna tuner, which is 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. It may be 25 ohms, it may be 100 ohms, it may be 50 with some reactance, capacitive or inductive, but it's a 2-to-1 viswire. It's somewhere on that 2-to-1 viswire circle on that Smith chart. If my antenna tuner is a good PI network and has enough range to it, we'll do a perfect impedance match. So now, let's assume now that I've got an even number of half, I've got a number of half wavelengths in that transmission line so that the 25 ohms of the antenna comes down to the antenna tuner at 25 ohms, and the antenna matches the 25 to the 50, the transmitter's happy, the antenna tuner's happy, the feed line's got a 2-to-1 viswire, but the antenna is now matched. The fact that the antenna feed line has multiple wavelengths doesn't stop me from forming that resonance. You were about to start saying that, hey, the transmission line is some number of microseconds away from the antenna, and maybe the antenna is not resonating. But still, I'm presenting some kind of an impedance that's somewhere on the Smith chart. It's within the range that the antenna tuner can tolerate. And then, believe it or not, I am taking that particular impedance, taking all of that reflected power, and forcing it forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now. To accept that, I'll admit, is not easy at first. But here's the way you can test it. you can put a known 2-to-1 VSWR at the end of your cable, assuming your cable is low in loss. You can transmit 100 watts into it. You know that 10% of the power is coming back. 10 watts is coming back for every 100 watts going out. That's what a 2-to-1 VSWR is. And you would assume that 10 watts of dissipation continuously for the next 10 minutes, key down, would make something glow red hot. If you've got a good antenna tuner, and you run that key down into that 2-to-1 VSWR, or make it a 4-to-1 VSWR if you like, and run a key down for 10 minutes, if that antenna tuner is a good one, it will run ICE repeater.
Time out.
If it's a good antenna tuner, it will run ice cold. It is absorbing no power. The transmission line is not radiating the power, it's shielded. The antenna tuner is not radiating the power, it's running ice cold. The transmitter is not seeing the power. He's got a 50 ohm load on him. He's got a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio as far as he's concerned. So the reflected power ain't getting to the transmitter. The antenna tuner is not dissipating. It's running at ice cold. The cable is running a little bit warmer because it's running at a 2-to-1 VSWR if it had some loss to begin with. Ain't nothing left to radiate that power but the antenna. Step by step, you'll slowly agree. You're re-reflecting the power forward in phase until the antenna finally radiates it. You have forced that system, that radiating system, to be resonant at your frequency and radiate that power. That's what you did when you finally tuned that antenna tuner the right way. It's doing a hell of a lot more than first meets the eye. I don't blame you for being skeptical at first. You're supposed to ask a whole lot of questions about this, Bob, and you will eventually accept this, in my opinion, because step by step you can do every one of the tests that I just indicated and see it with your own eyes, with your own equipment, in your own shack, with your own hands, touching that cold antenna tuner. AC2AZ, K2RIW.
And KC2QNQ with a comment.
Go ahead while I swallow this a little bit.
Dick, should I pick it up?
You got it, Greg.
Glenn, but close enough. Just a quick comment about, the low loss on the, if the coax is low loss and, having the antenna, doing the tuning at the shack level or at the transceiver. Just one of the pitfalls that I've found with that in the past, I know we've talked about this before, but just to mention it again, is that if you're tuning inside the shack, and depending on the length of the cable, if you have a nice long length of cable up to the antenna, a lot of times the cable becomes part of the transmission system, and the nice pattern that you're kind of hoping to get off of the antenna isn't as effective anymore, because now the feed line starts radiating because of the mismatch in the coax, and you lose a lot of the pattern that you were hoping for, where if you have the better match, closer up towards the antenna, and the cable is closer to 50 ohms coming back down, you tend to get a much better pattern off of the antenna as opposed to adding the feed line in line. So it's not loss, but the pattern isn't as good. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2KY again.
Bell Record, guys. I'm going to add to what Glenn just said, and that is that many of you guys on this network have taken an 80-meter dipole and used it on 40 meters. And with coax feed, it worked pretty poorly until they went over to open wire line. And they said, hey, Dick, you've been telling us that the antenna tuner is going to correct all this. Well, that's an extreme case. It's an innocent-sounding situation, but it's an extreme case, and let me show you. A 80-meter dipole on double the frequency, 40 meters, or vice versa, 40-meter dipole fit on 80 meters, in either case, it's an extremely high VSWR. A half-wave dipole fed at the one-wavelength point is more than 1 or 2,000 ohms of impedance. That means it's got something like a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, 20-to-1 to 40-to-1 standing wave ratio. When you've got a standing wave ratio that high, even though you think your feed line has only got a half a dB of loss, it climbs precipitously, because now the power is bouncing back and forth in that transmission line maybe 100 times before it's finally radiated, and you're adding up all the loss of that cable all of those times. So that's an extreme case. And there's another thing going on. If you didn't have a balun on the end of the transmission line, and you're feeding it that way, you've got a ridiculously high voltage being presented to the shield of the transmission line, which forces it to be part of the radiating system. If you did have a balun at the end, The Ballon, when you read the spec sheet on it, it's rated for a 2-to-1 Viswas max and maybe a 300 watts max. And you're not exceeding the 300 watts, but you're exceeding the 2-to-1. You've got a 20-to-1 or a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio. As such, the ferrite beads that are inside of that Ballon saturate. It starts dissipating power. It stops acting as a Ballon. And a substantial amount of the RF energy, even though you've got a Ballon there, in name, a substantial amount of the RF energy is now presented to the outside of the coax cable. And all of a sudden you've got RF in the shack, your D104 microphone bites you in the lip when you're transmitting, your Viswas is extremely high, the antenna tuner is cranking with all it's got, it hasn't got enough range to it. It's a terrible system. You can get away with that with open wire line. The open wire line doesn't require a Ballon. It's got such extremely low loss, like a tenth of a dB, it can tolerate a 20-to-1 Viswas. So if you...
Repeater, time out.
So if you feed that 80-meter dipole on 40 meters, but you're doing it with a broadband antenna tuner, an open wire line, it'll work like a charm. That's the one case where what I'm saying falls down real fast. You've got an extreme case like that. The idea of doing the antenna impedance matching in the shack doesn't work very well anymore. Mel's going to make all this a lot clearer for us. K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel. K2RAW.
And this is K2KEY. Well, see, the point is, with an antenna tuner, it does tune the antenna. However, as Walt Maxwell said, that we cannot change remotely the physical electrical characteristics. Antenna are fixed dependent on length, height, and surroundings. However, what we can do with the tuner, as Dick just said, we can fix certain things. But we must understand the antenna tuners should be given, they should give you a factor. See, they don't really give you a factor. In the antenna tuner, there is a factor called the Z and the R and the X. This is basically what the tuner is doing. It's fixing. In other words, at resonance, if we look at the antenna terminals at resonance, the circuit looks like a, purely resistive. It looks like a pure resistor without any other components. Now, as soon as we move off that frequency, that resonant frequency, we begin to put in capacitive, either capacitive or inductive reactants. So now to tune this with the tuner, to fix this up, of course we could measure it and we see that, well, the antenna is inductive. We could actually just put a variable capacitor and fix it up and balance it out that way. But your antenna tuner actually is doing that, whether it becomes inductive, it has a capacitor in there. If it becomes capacitive reactant, it has an inductor to fix it. But you should know what is its range. In other words, you can make the antenna measurement, and if you know the Z, the R, and the X, and then know your tuner's capability of the Z, R, and X, you'll know whether it's practical for this tuner to fix the antenna problem. I think that's where the misunderstanding is. What is the Z, R, and X capability of the tuner versus what is the Z, R, X of the antenna system, Dick? Over.
I like that. A man's got to know his limitations, as Clint Eastwood would say. You've got to know the limitations of the hardware you're using. If it's a no-tune transmitter, solid state, the manufacturer, if he's telling the truth, may tell you that it's going to start cutting back in power if you exceed a 1.8 standing wave ratio coming out of that transmitter. Your antenna tuner can tolerate a certain magnitude of R and X and overall Z. Another way of stating that is if the antenna tuner manufacturer did a really thorough job, he would give you a Smith chart and he would color in a portion of the Smith chart. And he would say, everything in that colored in portion, I can correct. And if it can not correct more than a 3-to-1, there's going to be a circle of 3-to-1 standing wave ratio where the center of the chart out to a 3-to-1 radius is colored. And he can cover any bit of that. That's if it's a nice, simple solution. In reality, he may have done it as a pi-t network, and it's not a pure circle on the chart. it's a slightly lumpy circle. And maybe he can tolerate a slightly lower impedance than he can a higher impedance. So it won't be a completely symmetric diagram. But if he did a thorough job, there's a portion of that Smith chart he should color in and say anywhere in that colored region, this antenna tuner will handle it. Outside of that color region, you ain't going to get a complete match with this antenna tuner. He should give you that. He doesn't. But if you're smart enough, you can measure the, you can look at the value of the components he's got, how big is the inductor, how big is the C1 and C2 capacitor, and so on, and you could calculate that. You could calculate ahead of time with programs you can find on Google that will tell you exactly where that section of the chart is that your antenna tuner will tolerate. Hey, with any further questions and comments on this, give me a call. Let us right now. KQLIW in the second net.
Hey,
Neil Quigley. Gary, recognize. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I appreciate this from you guys. I'm actually starting to get this. But I just wanted to add that I noticed on my antenna tuner, I get the best results if I can, if I minimize the series inductance that I use in my Pi network. If I use the minimum series inductance that I can get away with, and then tune the capacitor on the transmitter side and on the load side, it's actually, I get a better, more efficient radiation.
How do you know the radiation is more efficient? Are you using a bird watt meter and you see greater amount of forward power going up the feed line? Is that what's going on, Gary?
No, it's actually just perception based on results that I've gotten, you know, making DX contacts. Sometimes I found from experience that I had a field strength meter, and it appeared at one point at pointing for the best VSWR doesn't give you the best radiation, which I guess goes along with what you guys are saying here. But I found that if you actually, you know, what I'm saying probably isn't totally correct, because one time I made a contact on 12 meters and I had the the inductor position was at the lowest setting, or the largest inductor rather than the smallest. So what was happening is it was working really well, but you know, I started to see smoke after a while, and then I realized that I had made a mistake and now I had the thing tuned. But luckily I didn't damage anything.
Okay, you're feeling that if you use minimum inductance, you get the best efficiency out of the antenna tuner. For a particular impedance of your antenna, that is true. And I'm going to guess, if, for instance, your antenna was only a resistive mismatch, and if the antenna was 25 ohms instead of 50 ohms, possibly the best tuning would be minimum inductance. If your antenna was 100 ohms instead of 50 ohms, again a 2-to-1 visor, maybe the higher inductor rating would work better. You can find this out. Because impedance inverts on a transmission line every quarter wavelength, you can tune the antenna tuner with the minimum inductance where you get the best performance on that particular band, then plug in an extra eighth wavelength of transmission line and repeat the process. And I think you'll find out the most efficient setting of the antenna tuner would be an entirely different amount of inductance. It depends on the impedance your particular antenna presents on that particular band. So always going to minimum inductance may not be the best all the time, if you see what I'm saying, Gary. N2SCL, K2LAW.
Send a suggestion from K2KY.
Gary first. Go ahead, Gary.
Okay, yeah, all right, it makes sense. It makes sense, Dick. I get what you're saying, and this is good for me, because I'm actually learning here. Go ahead, Mel.
By the way, as long as your feed line is not itself radiating, as long as you've got a proper balancing structure and a whole lot of current, common mode current flowing down the outside of the transmission line is not taking place, then using a bird watt meter in the line going to the antenna. When you set the antenna tuner so that the forward apparent power is maximized on that frequency, assuming only one frequency is coming out of the transmitter, when you maximize the forward power, you are maximizing your radiation. is almost no exception to that one. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, what I was going to suggest for him to do, instead of using the transmitter and trying these combinations, use an antenna analyzer, any of the antenna analyzers, and look and see what your result is, because a number of these antenna analyzers like that are out right now, like MFJ and all, you can look at the resistive value, you can look at the reactance. It will show you all that. And now you will actually get a better view than trying to work strictly with the SWR. In other words, you may find a number of combinations, almost all of them, where a certain inductance and a certain capacitance, or a certain capacitance and a certain inductance. In other words, it goes both ways. You can swing these things around different ways and find that you'll get several, possibly several different combinations, and you'll say which one is the ideal one. And using your MFJ or time wave or any of them, or Ortec analyzers, they can tell you which is the proper match, rather than trying it with a transmitter and an SWR bridge to take over.
Yeah, every bit of information you can gather is going to be useful if you're smart enough to use it correctly. Whether you use an RX bridge, an impedance analyzer, a network analyzer, measure forward and reverse power with all kinds of instrumentation, check the phase angle. Even if you can't measure phase angle, put on known dummy loads of 250-ohm loads in parallel on a T-connector. By putting in known short, open, and known VISWA loads, you'll eventually figure out exactly what your system is doing. Left by hook or by crook, without expensive instrumentation, you can find out exactly what the impedance of your antenna is at your end of the transmission line. Knowing how many feet of transmission line of this particular velocity factor you're using, you know exactly how to crank out the transmission line on that Smith chart, so to speak, and you'll be able to figure out exactly what your antenna is. You'll be able to eventually find out what is the real impedance range that your antenna tuner can tolerate, and what's the best way to set it. As you set the antenna tuner for high or low inductance, high or low capacitance, for this particular antenna at this particular frequency, by way of the program, by way of the equation that's in the theory section of the amateur handbook, where they recommend a loaded Q of 10 for your particular PI network. Most antenna tuners are something like a PI network. And so for each particular impedance of your antenna presented to the antenna tuner, there is an ideal setting of the L and C that will give you a Q of 10. What's magic about a Q of 10? Let me drop. If you misset the controls, you may be able to hit a Q of 100. The good news of the Q of 100 of that PI network inside of your antenna tuner is that you'll be rejecting the higher harmonics with much more alacrity, with much more enthusiasm, let's say. That's the good news. The bad news is that Q is defined as the current rise at resonance. If you're running with a Q of 100 instead of a Q of 10, that means the circulating currents in your antenna tuner are 10 times higher than normal. And when they're 10 times higher than normal, unless you've got very beefy components, something is going to start smoking. And if you go in the opposite direction, if you tune for minimum inductance and maximum capacitance or whatever, you may end up with a Q of 3, which means you're not going to have very much range of tuning capability, and you're not going to have very much rejection of higher harmonics. Some people like to use the antenna tuner as one more filter to get rid of television interference, because the second harmonic out of their transmitter, even though it's 65 dB down and it meets the FCC requirement, that second harmonic may be disturbing the daylights out of the other television set in the house or the neighbor's set, and you've got television interference. And the antenna tuner knocked down the harmonics another 20 or 30 dB. So some people are using an antenna tuner simultaneously in that manner. So there are ways you can study your particular situation to find out what's the ideal setting of the controls on your antenna tuner so that it has a Q of approximately 10, which is usually the best ballpark region to be operating in. You can find out how to do that, even though it's got multiple ways of setting. And some of these automatic antenna tuners will occasionally find the wrong setting. K2LIW, listening. Anyone else with any further questions or comments?
Hey, Dick, you just actually hit on I guess I should have mentioned this. When I tune up in a specific band at a specific frequency, I also look for getting the broadest band match that gives me a good SWR. So I guess I was kind of blindly attempting to find that best cue point that you just discussed. Okay, I'm done.
In KC2QIQ with a comment?
Glenn recognized, yep, you hit it on the head. When you set the antenna tuner by missetting it and get a Q of 100 in my crazy example, it'll be very mistuned when you just QSY a little bit. Well, be careful how you judge that one. Your particular antenna, for instance, if I was using a 80-meter antenna on 40 meters or a 40-meter antenna on 80 meters, because it is such an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna, because it is so mistuned, automatically it will be a very narrow band antenna. So there could be a narrow band characteristic to your antenna, so when you QSY 10KC, everything goes haywire until you retune it. But if the antenna is known to have a reasonable bandwidth, and if all of a sudden with your antenna tuner, things go pretty haywire pretty fast when you only tune 10 or 20KC up the band, then the possibility exists that you're using the antenna tuner in the wrong manner. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, you got it, Glenn.
Hey, talk about...
Yeah, interestingly enough, Dick, I came across a problem a couple of years ago with these automatic antenna tuning circuits. Actually, in a mobile situation, that was kind of interesting. I was using a Tar Heel 400 antenna, which is a motor-driven screwdriver antenna that tunes from 10 through 80 meters. And interestingly enough, I was using one of the N2VZ Enterprises automatic antenna tuners with the ICOM 7000, so you can press the button on the transceiver, and it puts the transceiver into a low power mode, like 10 watts, and basically the screwdriver antenna searches until it finds a good match, then it stops, and then it'll allow you to put out full power. But interestingly enough, I had the sensing device, this N2VZ circuit, very, very close to the transceiver, thinking that I'm getting the best match as close to the transceiver as possible. But I found out that the antenna had a terrible time trying to search and stop, and was having a hard time finding a match, where when I actually moved the controller closer to the antenna with the least amount of cable between the antenna and the controller, all of a sudden the performance was 10 times better. It was actually able to find the set point match much quicker and stop, just because I was adding maybe an extra 10 feet of cable. It was enough just to confuse that little circuit. Very odd. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
An automatic antenna tuner measures the phase angle of the reflected signal as well as its magnitude, makes a judgment, and tries to adjust itself accordingly to do a good impedance match. Most antenna tuners, if the VISWR is high enough and the phase angle is in one of those forbidden regions, it could come up with a false answer. And sometimes it'll go searching forever and the modal will never settle down, or it does settle down, but it's on a wrong reading. Once again, the problem is that if the antenna tuner was properly designed, and if the manufacturer really was giving you all the information he should be giving you, if this is the best of all worlds, he would be presenting to you a Smith chart, and a portion of the Smith chart would be covered, colored in, and he would be telling you, this antenna tuner works best in those colored in regions. And if you go outside of that region, we don't guarantee what it's going to do. It may come up with the wrong answer. It may not behave correctly. It may not give you a good match. You're using it beyond its design capability. So it would be nice if they could give you one of those. Hey, we should go over to Paul because he's got to get up early in the morning, and I think he's got some good information for us. WS2N, I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Paul. K2RIW on the TechNet. Hello, Paul.
Yes, go ahead, Dick.
I hope we haven't put you to sleep. Go ahead, Paul. I know you've got some good information. What's NASA doing today?
Okay, I'm playing around on the computer. That's on the other side of the room. So trying to keep the two separate. Endeavour was supposed to go up today. It was delayed yesterday because of rain, and now it's delayed again because of thunderstorms too near the launch pad. They have to be within at least 20 miles away, and they were 10 miles away. They were getting lightning strikes, so that's 2 days in a row. They will try tomorrow again for STS-127 at 7:13 p.m. I'll have to look for that. Let's see. Let me drop it. The mission is supposed to go up to the International Space Station. Endeavour was the one that was waiting on the launch pad for Atlantis on the last mission that went up to the Hubble in case that had a problem. That was going to be the standby spacecraft to, for rescue. So he had one at 39A and the other one at 39B, and sitting out at the launch pad when that occurred. But now Endeavour is going to go on its own mission to the space station. Not too many more of these left, including STS-127. You now have 7 missions left for the space shuttle, and then to get other Americans up there, they'll be buried up by the Russians on the Soyuz. There's already crews picked for that for the next couple of years anyway, on how they're going to handle that. Unfortunately, I still haven't heard anything about extending the shuttle program. Back to you, Dick. WS2.
Okay, this worries me a little bit. Maybe I'm just being a grandmother on this one, Paul. Columbia, as I remember, launched on the second day. Challenger launched on the second day. When you've got the cryogenic materials in the external tank for more than the first day, you go into the second day, and now it looks to me like they're going into the third day, which means whatever portion of the insulation on that external tank that's not perfect is getting continuous what's called cryo-pumping, which means air is being liquefied, moisture is being added to the foam, and therefore the ice is building up on that foam. Therefore, the chances of damage occurring because ice breaking away during that launch could damage the shuttle. I didn't know that they had the ability to go into the third day. Am I correct in assuming that the cryogenic materials have been in the external tank for going on 2 separate days now, and now they're going into the third day? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it was 48 hours, so I guess if they tried the launch yesterday and then today and then tomorrow, that gives them the 48-hour spread there, I guess, a few more hours more than that, but I think after that, of course, that's it. I did hear if they don't launch tomorrow, they'll have to wait until the end of July. You have another shuttle going up. I think the next one that goes up is in October. In between that, you have in August, you have the first launch of the Ares V rocket. That's the first rocket that's going to replace the shuttle. They're going to test that. So, that's why after tomorrow at this time, 6:51. If it doesn't go up, then that'll be the end. I'd like to see if we can get this mission done because that almost really completes the space station. This is the third flight for the Kaibo Japanese space module. Let me drop it. The first one was put up a while back. Big, gigantic cylinder, the biggest module up there, bigger than the European Space Agency's Columbia, bigger than the Americans' Destiny module. It's bigger than the Russian one. It's just a huge living area. Then they attached another one on top of that. So it looks like if you took a beer can and laid it down, took a half a beer can, cut it in half, put it on top of that laid down beer can. That top part is the second part of the module. This one going up is like an outdoor platform, like a patio, attached to this combination modules. And what it's meant for is to put experiments outdoors, you know, in the back of the space, and they can run experiments. There's robotic arms that they use to put the stuff in and out on this porch. But it's a big thing. I mean, you know,
at 8 o'clock.
It's not a small little patio that they're putting out there. It's huge. It's got to be maybe half the length of the first module that they put up. Back to you, Dick.
Complete.
Let me ask you this, Paul. If they have to launch within 48 hours, or else they take all the cryogenic materials out of the external tank and reschedule a week or two later, what is the stated reason that they must launch within 48 hours? Is it because the lineup between the ground and the space station is not proper? Or is it something about the vehicle itself? Over to you, Paul.
Well, they've got the 2-day, like you said, the cryogenics, it could only last so long. But after that, there's a scheduled launch coming up that they have to get ready for. And there's a lot of, there's a lot of preparation that has to go beyond, for this. So to get that launch off, they have to, end of July, I think, end of this month, would be the next available window. Let me think now. Probably be now, let's see, you're coming to the end of 2 days, so the end of July would be because you have to pump down the shuttle. By the way, this has been done 1 month ago. This thing was supposed to go up. It didn't go up because of hydrogen leaks in the line. You might remember that. So you combine all these things together. I think this is the third or fourth time the fourth time they've been out to the launch pad, ready to go. But then after that, after the end of July, if it doesn't go, they have to wait a real long time because you've got these other flights that are planned. It'll just go down after the other ones, after October, I guess, they would launch. Back to you, Dick.
Something is bothering me here, Paul. You're saying that they've got to launch within 48 hours when they install the cryogenic materials in that external tank. Let's assume that right now they exceed the 48 hours. For whatever reason, they don't launch at 7 o'clock p.m. tomorrow, and that there is a possible window to meet up with the space shuttle, International Space Station, at not the 48th hour, but the 55th hour. You've already got the whole vehicle and all of the jazz that goes with it sitting on launch pad 39A right now. There is no quicker way of getting that out of the way as far as the next launch is concerned, other than to launch it if they were allowed to go beyond 48 hours. Assuming there is a window of opportunity to meet the space station, I think there's something to do with the cryogenics itself that you can't go beyond 48 hours. And I'm guessing it's ice buildup. And this is what's bothering me. They attempted a launch before where I guess the cryogenics were in there for 2 days. And then they warmed everything up and removed all the cryogenic materials. Now for the last 2 days, cryogenic materials are in there again. You're thermally cycling that foam. You're cryo-pumping it. The ice that's formed in that foam, and there's a certain amount of ice that forms, is expanding and loosening up that foam. By the time you load up those tanks the third time, if they don't go tomorrow, I think you're really pushing your luck on that particular external tank as to whether or not it's going to have chunks of foam that break away. I am guessing that's the problem that causes them not to go beyond 48 hours. It has less to do with the window of opportunity of meeting the shuttle, meeting the space station, because they have enough maneuverability, they can find a way of meeting it. WS2N, KQRIW.
This is WS2N. Let me think now. You're making it seem like they're pumping the tanks down dry in between these, each day. I don't think you're saying that because I think you know that they're not. So, once they're all pumped up, the shuttle is full. You've got roughly 2 days, I guess it's 2.5 days before they'll pump these things down. you never see the shuttle, like, up there for, you know, 4 or 5 days at a time. So it's probably, you know, not 48 hours, maybe it's 50 hours or 60, you know, whatever it is, 2.5 days. But you're right in the, it's only going to get colder, putting more stress on everything every time you do this. I mean, it was done a month ago. Don't forget the tank that we're talking about are really the external tanks. These are one-shot pieces of equipment. They go up and they detach, and that tank winds up burning up and going into the Indian Ocean or the North Atlantic, depending on the trajectory of the of all these shuttles that have gone up over the years. Lately, it's always the Indian Ocean because the it's lately it's the North Pacific, and they get rid of these tanks. So you know, so many times you're definitely gonna put more stress on them. Probably more and more stuff is gonna come off the outside, the insulation. Let me drop it.
Yeah, let me ask you the question on this one. You load up all the cryogenic materials and you try to make a launch within two and a half days. Then you drain the tanks and wait a month, and then start the process all over again. To my knowledge, there is no spigot on the bottom of the tank in which you boil off those fluids, in which you drain those fluids. I think you have to get them out of the tank by boiling them off. So the draining process is a considerably lengthy process. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
They pumped, that's pumped out. Released into the atmosphere on both tanks? No, that would take forever. Millions of gallons. I know all that venting you see going off is just a constant way of keeping, you know, the pressure stabilized within the tanks. You see that at the top, you got that big cap on top that moves out of the way. That's sucking all the gases from the shuttle as it's sitting there on the pad, and they're constantly adding more as that vaporizes. But no, it's a pump down situation. I've heard that before. They'll pump these fluids back to the tanks, you know, gigantic storage tanks that they have stored there. No, I never heard that they would vent everything off at all there. I was trying to remember something I was going to say about this process, but it's gone out of my head. Let's see. I don't know. I don't want to labor it anymore, but it'll come back to me later. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, in the case of these great big tanks with millions of gallons, let's assume they do have a drain valve at the bottom where they can take out the fluid and put it back into their local storage tanks. But still, you're taking very, very cold temperatures from those tanks and warming them back up to room temperature. And now we've done it two periods in a row, 2 days, some number of weeks ago, the last 2 days. If they don't go tomorrow, we're going to be bringing it all back to room temperature and then repeating the whole process. Each time you go through that complete thermal cycle, I think we're stressing the materials, we're stressing the tank. I think the reliability decreases. And so the previous errors occurred on second day of launch, and that worries me. I don't know of any great solution to this. By the way, you did vent off the tanks the hard way in the case of Apollo 13, and that particular heater was overstressed, and that's what created the failure in that particular case. But that was a much smaller tank used in the command service module, and the failure of a thermal switch in that particular tank aggravated that particular situation. There, I don't think they had a real drain valve. Here, you'd have to have a drain valve because of Sedan, many millions of gallons involved. Let's hope they go tomorrow. Let's hope it's without incident, but I'm a little concerned, as you can tell. Anything else you want to tell us about what NASA is doing? And this particular mission, is the module being brought up a particularly heavy module, or is it a fairly light module from your point of view, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
No, compared to the original Kaibo living quarters module, it's probably half the length, and it's, you know, an outdoor structure. What it weighs, I don't know. I really don't even know how much room it takes up in the cargo bay. It might be one of these things that, you know, unfurl and, you know, after they take it out, probably does. Looks like, you know, if you see pictures of it, it looks like a gigantic patio attached to the Kaibo living quarters. And, you know, you could have a couple of astronauts looking out the window at this thing and operating built-in robotic arms specifically for this unit that are attached to the Japanese unit. So that's the story on that. On the, you see, you're worried about these joints breaking, these O-rings around the solid boosters. You know, that's a little different story. Cold weather created that problem. The tanks themselves get cold a bit. They're insulated. The solid boosters are not cryogenically cooled, but they are affected by cold temperatures. And that's the problem with the Challenger shuttle, which tried, four or five different times to get us off the ground. And the O-rings get so cold, they become brittle, and it allowed hot gases to pass from inside the solid booster the tanks. They've kind of like solved that problem by redesigning the joint. They created like a J-type of structure for the joints going all the way around these 12-foot diameter solid boosters. Let me drop it. They also installed heaters surrounding that whole circumference as well. So, for particularly cold days, they've also changed the temperature. The launch temperature used to be 30 degrees. Now they've gone up to 35, maybe 34, 33, depending on humidity. But the average temperature they've raised from 30 to 35, and that was January 27th, 1984, I think it was, when that thing blew up. So it was cold, and they've changed flight rules regarding that. They've also changed quite a bit of other things too. All the safety things that were involved, and they now have a pole that they can jump out at low altitude. They can't do it in outer space, but if they had problems, they could get out of this thing like a fireman's pole and parachute back down. You know, all kinds of stuff. Landing gear, you name it. Hundreds of changes that they've made, and they still make. Back to you, Bill.
Yeah, the Challenger was an O-ring failure on a solid rocket booster. Columbia was a failure where a chunk of foam, with or without ice in it, broke away from the external tank, fell rearward, and hit the leading edge of the wing of the shuttle, created damage to the tiles on the leading edge, and that created the Challenger failure. And so foam breaking away from the upper portions of the external tank is the thing that I'm concerned about. And second and third day and fourth day launches, I think, are aggravating that problem. But the good news is they're going to the space station, which can act as a way station, a safety place to stay until a repair can be made and another shuttle can be brought up. So thank goodness this is not a launch to the Hubble Space Telescope where there is no rescue capability. Thank you for any comments on all of that, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, their rescue capability was this flight endeavor. They would have sent four astronauts up to get the five that were up there doing the Hubble, and they would have returned like that. So, they had plans for EVAs. They were going to dock one, let's say, right side up, and the other one upside down, and that's how they were going to dock. They were going to go on a tether from one end to the other. If they had a complicated system, too. A couple of guys going over, another guy going back, and some involved system on how they were going to evacuate the Atlantis if they needed to. Interesting reading. If you ever looked that up. I just don't want to leave this week without mentioning that I think this Thursday, I think it's the 16th, that's the 40th anniversary of of Apollo 11, which is the mission that did land on the moon. Newsday put out a nice Sunday article about the remembrances of a lot of the people involved in Grumman. Many of them retired, some of them dead, some of them have died. In one case, the wife of one guy that had died was in charge of the lunar module, Thomas Kelly, I believe it was. And good story. Newsday did a pretty good job at that. And of course, the 20th was the actual landing. Back to you, Dick.
So I think you're saying 16th was the launch, 20th was the landing. Was the actual moonwalk of Neil Armstrong, in which he said the famous words, "One small step for a man," we hope that A was really there, "one giant step for mankind," did that occur on July 20 or July 21? I think it was July 20. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, the 20th. It was supposed to go to 21st. They were a little anxious. They wanted them to, "Oh, you're supposed to go to sleep when you got there." And I mean, forget about it. They looked out that window and said, "We want to go now." And they said, "It's up to you." So they went out on the 20th. So, and now Buzz Aldrin has a new book out. And his first words on the moon was what, Dick?
John, good question. That I don't know. I think the actual landing occurred, the actual moonwalk, the very first step on the moon, I think it occurred like 8 or 9 o'clock New York time on a Thursday night. No. I bet it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday. I know that the day of launch for them to come back home, I think that occurred on a Friday, and certain companies canceled work that day because we were all glued to our television set. What day of the week was the actual walk, Paul? Being a good trivia expert, you might know that. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, but a terrible reader. I just read it. I just read it the other day. They didn't have it in the paper. They had the date and the time in today's paper. If they had the date, I missed it. I thought it was a Sunday for some reason. But somebody will jump on and tell you. Yeah. And the name of the book is the word that Buzz Aldrin said, "Magnificent Desolation." So he's got this new book out. I haven't read it yet. Back to you.
Yeah, I've got a computer program and one of my calculators here. I know I put it in the other room, which will give you the Julian date for any date from 1600 to the next couple hundred years. So I can plug in 1969, July 20, and I'll find out exactly what the Julian date and the day of the week was. I'll do that maybe on your next transmission. And sad that I don't remember what day of the week it was, but I know that the day that they launched, the company I was working for, I was supposed to go to work, and they canceled work that day because they knew everyone would be glued to the set and nothing good was going to happen. And it was such a magnificent event, particularly if it didn't go well. That rocket engine that's on that ascent module on the moon, you only get one chance on that that piece of hardware. If for whatever reason that doesn't go, it is game over. And let's see, we've had Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So we've had six actual moonwalks. That engine worked perfectly six times. Can you imagine the conversations over that communication circuit if that launch engine doesn't work? Over to you, Paul, for any comment on that one.
Yeah, there were a couple of little stories about that very topic in the Newsday today, about the concern over one guy. His biggest thrill was not really them walking on the moon. His thrill was when that engine lit off, and he knew that the work that they had done in Grumman paid off. And they had an interesting setup with those two chemicals. One of the fuels was supposed to be very toxic. You know, I mean, if you got it on anything, it was like an acid type of thing, by the way. So they had a special piping and this and that. But when they mixed these two together, they would ignite. There was no spark plug, you know. There was no glow coil, you know. I mean, the chemicals themselves were